But you're good, though. it doesn't come with a pay raise.
I know.
Okay. Next up is Smith versus City of Atlantic City. Take your time. Right, council are ready. Are you going to be reserving any time?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
That's granted, and you can proceed whenever you're comfortable.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. This is Kayla Toney on behalf of plaintiff Alexander Smith. With me at council table is Becky Dummermuth from First Liberty Institute. In Graf v. DeJoy, the Supreme Court unanimously restored Title VII's protections for people of faith by requiring employers to grant religious accommodations. The only way they can avoid this duty is to show substantial increased cost to the operation of the business. But the district court below denied that protection to Pastor Alex Smith, who's worked for the safety of his community for the past 20 years. Under Graf, it's the department's burden to show undue hardship, and they haven't done so. They haven't quantified any costs from accommodating Mr. Smith. The department also failed to offer alternative accommodations, especially since Mr. Smith's position does not require him to wear a mask or to engage in fire
suppression. I guess your friend across the aisle says something a little bit different, that there could and actually has once at least been a chance where it was sort of all hands on deck and everybody needed to be possibly firefighting.
Your Honor, that is a key disputed fact in this case, which calls for a remand. It is a genuine issue of material fact, and this court can only affirm if there are no genuine issues of material fact.
He does not want to be a civilian. He's a firefighter. As a matter of definition of firefighter, shouldn't you be able to suppress fire?
Your Honor, his position used to involve fire suppression every day.
But his position is firefighter. Now, he has a role of air mask technician, but he's not a civilian, correct? And he does not want to be a civilian.
It's correct that he's not a civilian, Your Honor. His role is air mask technician, and
a firefighter. He's being paid as a firefighter, not as a civilian.
It was a promotion to the role of air mask technician,
he's paid more. As a firefighter. Not as a civilian.
Your Honor, regardless of the label that the department uses
Is that right or not, as a matter of fact?
His job is not to engage in fire suppression.
He is being paid as a firefighter. Is that right, as a matter of fact?
It is not, Your Honor. He's being paid as an air mask technician, which is a higher level
administrative position. What is a civilian position? Is he being paid what a civilian is paid?
He's not listed as a civilian on the organizational chart. I think the organizational chart is actually helpful here in the record, Your Honor, because it shows that his role is an administrative one. His label is a firefighter on the organizational chart, but his role is an administrative one, and the department's longstanding practices back that up.
His role as a firefighter is an air mask technician, and he's being paid as a firefighter, not as a civilian.
That's correct. And his job is primarily done at the fire shop, which is an administrative role. His job is to fit test other colleagues who do engage in fire suppression. And his job when he is called to the scene of a fire is to stay with the air unit outside of the hot zone that's immediately dangerous to life and health. It's very important that he stays outside of that zone so that his colleagues who are fighting the fire can come to him and refill their air bottles, readjust their air masks safely. And so it's very important that he stays away from the structure fire. when he's there at the scene, and that is for the safety of his colleagues. And that's why in his 8 years as an air mask technician, he is not needed to wear an SCBA mask. And that's also why the previous air mask technician filed two affidavits in this case in the record at 676 and 278, where he testified that no previous air mask technician for the past 37 years had ever needed to wear an SCBA mask. And that's because fire suppression just isn't part of their role. Their role is to keep their colleagues safe by refilling those air bottles. And here, the department has not met its burden under Graf v. DeJoy to show that accommodating Mr. Smith would actually result in any increased cost.
But if the force is, as I understand it, 189 firefighters, even one firefighter's accommodation, wouldn't that be a substantial increased cost as discussed in Graf?
Your Honor, I will note that the force has recently expanded to 196 firefighters, okay, most of whom are fully trained to engage in fire suppression. But there's only one.
This at the time of at the time the decision was made? I mean, whatever their present resources are, I mean, that's nice that they have more resources, but I mean, that's not part of the record here, and that's not part of the decision making at the time. And aren't we reviewing the decision at the time it was made?
Yes, Your Honor. And if you look to the expert testimony at the time the decision was made on that point, it's very significant that at the scene of a fire, Mr. Smith is the only one who's trained to safely operate the air unit. And so it would not be a hardship for the department to accommodate his beard request because he doesn't need to wear an SCBA mask.
But I don't think that's what the record reflects. The record reflected that you have to be certified to fix the air masks, you have to be certified to do the testing, but that anyone could fill the bottles. That's what I read in the record.
Your Honor, that's another disputed fact. The chief did testify something to that effect at deposition, but that's very different from Mr. Smith's long-standing experience and deposition testimony, as well as expert Krause's deposition testimony.
So is it also a disputed fact that other people had been trained to fill the bottles?
No, Your Honor, there are a few others who know how. But they are not specifically called to the scene of the fire for that role. And what expert Krause testified is that the mission, it's very important to accomplish the mission of safely fighting the fire, that each person stick with the role that they've been trained for and that they've been assigned to. And that's the department's longstanding practice for the past 37 years, is that the air mask technician stays with the rig, he stays with the air unit to make sure that those men and women can get the clean air they need. And that's what Mr. Smith has been committed to all these years.
Can I ask you, there was some testimony in the record that the state czar, I guess, who was overseeing the fire department at the time, had pressured the chief to civilianize this role. Can you speak to whether or not let's just assume that he doesn't need to actually suppress fire. Can you speak to what skills being a firefighter, like what that experience is and how it's necessary for that role? Or is the only difference between a civilian AMT and a firefighter AMT suppression of fire? Do you, I know that was like a little bit long of a question. Do you understand what I mean? I mean, if you remove fire suppression, is the AMT essentially a civilian? Or is there some aspect of AMT work that necessitates the prior years of experience as a fire suppressor?
That's a great question, Your Honor, but it's not something that you all need to decide today.
If you have an answer to it?
I believe that Mr. Smith's previous experience as a firefighter is certainly helpful to his role, but his role no longer involves fire suppression. So he could do his current role even if he had never fought fires.
So it could be a civilian role?
Technically, and that's actually one potential alternative accommodation that the department failed to consider. The department completely failed to discuss alternative accommodations with Mr. Smith, and if it had, it would have learned that he would have been comfortable with a quarter-inch beard where he could still safely wear an SCBA mask.
And would have been comfortable in a civilian role instead?
Potentially, Your Honor, but that's not something he ever had the opportunity to discuss with the department, and it's the department's burden under Graf to raise and consider alternative accommodations. It's not enough to simply reject one request and then move on. They have to consider those alternatives, and they never did, and that's why they failed to meet their burden here under Title VII.
Question. Has the Supreme Court abrogated our precedent that applying intermediate scrutiny to cases like this? I'm thinking in particular of the Kennedy case.
Yes, Your Honor. The district court erred in applying the wrong standard to the free exercise claim. Strict scrutiny should apply here. As you mentioned in Kennedy, that was in the public employment context. The court never considered intermediate scrutiny there, simply applied strict scrutiny to find for Mr. Kennedy. And actually, if you read this court's own precedents back in Fraternal Order, and then Tenafly, and then Blackhawk, in Blackhawk, then Judge Alito made very clear that strict scrutiny was what he applied in Fraternal Order of Police. The only reason he used the term heightened scrutiny was that the city in that situation failed at any level of scrutiny. And so that's why he chose that term. But he clarified in Blackhawk that it was, in fact, strict scrutiny. And strict scrutiny applies here for several reasons. First, we have a system of individualized exemptions where Mr. Smith and others have requested exemptions and the department has considered them. They've evaluated the underlying reasons for the exemptions, which is something that Lukumi and Tenafly both mention. And as part of that evaluation, there's some discretion over whether to grant them.
The exemptions are what? The captain can make an exception if he wants. He's responsible for whatever might happen, but he can do it. Is that, that's one?
Yes, Your Honor. There's authority to deviate.
What else? Is there the sideburn, five o'clock shadow? Is that another? I mean, just go through what are the exceptions that we're supposed to consider?
Yes, Your Honor. So as you mentioned, quote, authority to deviate from the grooming procedure, end quote, is written into the policy at page 73. And then the emergency callback exception is also written into the policy. And that is where at the scene of a fire, in the rare event that more staff are needed, which happens roughly once a year in Mr. Smith's 15 years of experience, off-duty firefighters are allowed to grow beards when they're off duty. And when they're called in, the commander or the captain who's at the scene has the discretion in that moment to evaluate whether he thinks the firefighter has more than a 5 o'clock shadow. And if they do, and he's worried about the mask fit, he'll send them home or he'll send them off to shave. And if he thinks it's just a 5 o'clock shadow and it won't interfere with the mask fit, which you can safely wear a mask with up to a quarter inch of facial hair, then he allows them to go ahead and fight the fire. And so that policy on its face, it's a categorical exemption. And
well,
under
Mr. Smith is allowed to grow his beard off duty and he's allowed to show up in an emergency callback with whatever growth he had, and it would be evaluated the same as anyone else.
Correct, Your Honor. But under the Supreme Court's precedent in Tandon v. Newsom, the relative standard of comparison is the level of risk that the department is tolerating. And so if you look at the emergency callback exception, the level of risk they're tolerating is that someone might need to fight a fire with a 5 o'clock shadow, and they can safely do that because the way the masks work is that no toxins will flow into the person's lungs.
The testimony seemed to be that to the extent that number five, the clean shaven rule, and with that exception, does not conflict with number six. So maybe I have some hair that's just at the surface and about to emerge or just emerged, but does not qualify as stubble interfering with the seal under six, then that's not a violation of six and that person can proceed. But the testimony seems to be there is in fact never an exemption to facial hair that interferes in violation of number six.
Two quick points on that, Your Honor. Under Fulton v. City of Philadelphia, it's the discretion that the decision maker has in that moment to decide just how much facial hair is present and whether it might interfere with the seal. That triggers strict scrutiny. And the other way it does is that there's that system of potential exemptions, even if none are granted. In Fulton, no exemptions were ever granted to the city's non-discrimination policy, but the court still applies strict scrutiny.
But I think you're conflating number five and number six. I don't think that there's anything in the record that shows that there has ever been an exception to number six. Can you point to evidence in the record that there, in fact, has been a time where someone could wear, was permitted to suppress fire with an SCBA with stubble that prohibited the seal, I mean, interfered with the seal?
Your Honor, that is another key disputed fact that calls for a remand. It's unclear from the record. Our understanding is that some firefighters have fought fires with short beards in that emergency callback
situation.
That's
your understanding, but where in the record is there anything that reflects that?
Your Honor, I would point to the testimony from from Mr. Smith at page 305. He says we can respond to the scene of the fire without being clean shaven. And then Evan's declaration at 285 says that the exemption is designed to prevent firefighters from taking extra time to shave before reporting to the fire. And then at page 330, he says that the supervisor makes an assessment when a person shows up on the scene.
Let's say the record unambiguously showed that no one has ever gotten the advantage of that exception. Would it matter under Fulton?
It would not, Your Honor, because under Fulton, no exemptions had ever been granted. What mattered was that there was the discretion present for that government decision maker, which allowed him in the moment to evaluate the reasons for the person's request. And that's what gets you under strict scrutiny under the Free Exercise Clause.
Can I ask you one last thing? Apparently you're appealing, I think you're appealing denial of the preliminary injunction, but you already appealed that and dismissed the appeal. How did we reach that?
Your Honor, because...
With prejudice that was dismissed, right?
No, Your Honor, I believe it was without prejudice. I will confirm for rebuttal, okay. But I believe it was without because it was a voluntary dismissal. And because we have a final judgment on the merits under Inree Westinghouse from this court's precedent from 1996, the preliminary injunction ruling merges with the final judgment. So this court does have authority to review both decisions. And there's actually several examples, including in Tenafly, where this court reversed despite finding it only reasonably likely to show that the defendant violated the Free Exercise Clause. So they didn't even have to reach a merits conclusion, but that standard of reasonably likely or reasonable probability gives the court that authority to issue issue instructions for the preliminary injunction. And that's very important to Mr. Smith because then he doesn't have to continue to violate his conscience in order to keep his job, which no American should have to do under our country's laws.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll get you on rebuttal.
Good morning.
Hi.
May it please the court, my name is Ruby Kumar Thompson. I'm with the firm of Cleary, Giacobbe, Alfieri, and Jacobs, and we represent the city of Atlantic City. Your Honors, there is what this case is about is an accommodation that was requested to wear a 3-inch beard. And the claim that the firefighter suffered an adverse employment action. And the adverse employment action that the firefighter says that he suffered is the failure to be accommodated. In terms of a substantial increased cost, Atlantic City submits that there are two substantially increased costs to granting this firefighter an accommodation. The two costs are, first, the safety, security, and health of himself and the other firefighters should the plaintiff be required to fight a fire. The plaintiff is an air mask technician, but he is a firefighter as well. The essential duties of his job require him, in a case of an emergency, to have all hands on deck. There only takes one emergency. There's only one 9/11 for a firefighter to be able to come and be ready to fight fires. That is an essential requirement of his position. Disallowing a firefighter to wear a 3-inch beard works an undue hardship on the Atlantic City Fire Department because it is a safety hazard to him. And in addition, the accommodation would run afoul of binding state and federal regulations.
But I'm scratching my head over that one. Aren't you already not in compliance with the state regulations?
We have never granted an exception to anyone where the hair would compromise or that a firefighter where the hair would compromise the seal of the mask. The seal of the mask, the risk is much greater with a longer beard than a 5 o'clock shadow.
Understand it, if Smith were an off-duty firefighter coming in for an emergency, I'll ask you a question. If he were coming in for an emergency, would his facial hair be acceptable?
not at 3 inches, but a 5 o'clock shadow, that policy under number five is generally applicable to Smith, irrespective of anyone's religious or reasons for having that 5 o'clock shadow. It is a rule and a policy of general applicability. There is no exemptions for someone who's appears at a fire with a 5 o'clock shadow who isn't, who's not religious or doesn't do it for religious reasons or just does it because he didn't have time to shave.
But as I understand it, the state regs don't allow for sort of an emergency callback exception.
The state regulations require that the facial hair not interfere with the seal of the mask. There's sufficient scientific evidence and policy decisions from federal safety regulations to indicate that the hair, if it interferes with the mask, will not have a proper seal, will be a health and safety hazard to any firefighter who is on the scene of a fire.
Is the 5 o'clock shadow, like, I guess, a shorthand for saying not long enough to interfere with the seal?
That's correct.
And can you address Mr. Smith's point that he would have been willing to wear a quarter-inch beard and that a quarter-inch beard does not interfere with the seal? Is there anything in the record to contradict that a quarter-inch beard would not interfere with the seal?
So that's an interesting question because Mr. Smith, when he requested the accommodation, had a 3-inch beard. He put in his affidavit and as well in his complaint that his religious beliefs require him to have a minimum of a 3-inch beard. When we talk about interactive process and accommodating someone with a religious belief, we can't question that sincere religious belief. So to say that graft doesn't mean that the employer has to ask the employee to compromise their religion or their religious belief. Here it was a 3-inch beard. The accommodation is what is the accommodation that the employer can offer to accommodate that religious belief. And here, because of the safety regulations, because of federal OSHA regulations, there was no accommodation other than to exempt him.
So are you saying Groff does not require, did not require us to ask about shorter beard length because based on his own asserted religious obligation, that accommodation would have been futile?
Correct.
Can a state regulation, no matter how buttoned up it is with expert evidence and policy and so on, trump the free exercise clause?
The regulation provides an impossibility, in a sense. The regulation, the accommodations clause, the free exercise clause, doesn't require an employer to violate the law. It just doesn't. It's not a reasonable accommodation. It's an undue hardship. There's also fines.
Isn't every free exercise a challenge to the application of some law as being inconsistent with the free exercise clause?
Sure, if that was the claim that was made here, but there wasn't a claim or a challenge to the law itself. What we're talking about is the employer's actions and the employer's ability to accommodate a firefighter, which doesn't exist unless it would be in tension with the law.
Can I ask a question on the state regulations? The record refers to Patrick Bost, B-O-S-T. I'm unclear who that is or what relation he has to the case. I read his name, but there was no sort of explanation as to who this is. Do you know who that is?
I don't, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
We neither of us do then. Okay.
Post-Groff, talking to your point about breaking a state regulation, from what I can see, there's one precedential First Circuit case that addresses this and a non-precedential second. The precedential case talks about the record that reflected the serious penalties that could result from violating that, such as like the hospital could lose its license. Here, I really didn't see any evidence in the record about what the penalty would be for violating these PIOSH or P. whatever standards. So if you can address whether or not there is any such record, or if we can take judicial notice, and also if you could speak to, there's Mr. Smith testified or said in his deposition that ACFD regularly violates a PIOSH standard that an air truck be on scene at all times, whereas at night, ACFD does not call in an air truck due to overtime costs. So if they're, first of all, is that a standard and are they regulating, are they regularly flouting that? And does that reflect that there are no penalties for violating a PIOSH regulation?
No, the penalty, there is a penalty. There's a regulatory penalty under PIOSH, and the commissioner of PIOSH can issue a written order either for the department to comply, and then can also impose a $7,000 per day fine for each violation so long as it continues. So whether or not there are other requirements that are not being met means that they can be fined for that, but that doesn't mean that it lends itself to the unreasonable accommodation.
And that's for any violation of any?
That's correct. It's a general penalty application in PIOSH for the commissioner. The other substantial non-economic cost is, of course, breaching the public's trust and perception that all safety regulations are being followed by the ACFD should there be a written order to comply, of course. We need public trust in our public servants who are there to provide safety and fire suppression. The fact that that there's any argument that the plaintiff here does not need to suppress fires is completely not availed by the record whatsoever. It's absolutely his position to fight fires. Actually, the Atlantic City Fire Department does not have a light duty position at all for anyone, from medical exceptions or the like. They would have to take a leave.
So if someone is not capable of suppressing fire currently or at the time of this record, that means they were a civilian.
We have no civilian positions, but there are civilian positions in fire departments for air technicians that can be trained, just like a dispatcher can be a civilian position in a police department. In this department, all firefighters need to be ready and to either rescue another firefighter who may fallen or a search and rescue civilians or suppress a fire. In addition, the air mask technician needs to be close enough to the fire in order that the firefighters can be can arrive and get air quickly, correct? So the fact that he's in the area and the wind shifts can change would require him to wear a mask. The fact that he hasn't, I'm not quite sure what the circumstances were at those fires, but should there be a very large industrial fire, there certainly could be toxic fumes in the air, that he can't be that far away where he's not close enough to for the other firefighters to be safe and
okay,
refill
and
their
tanks. Just so I understand, so all... every single employee of ACFD is a firefighter.
Correct. Even the second air mask technician who did appear for that 2020 emergency in and perform firefighting functions.
Let's say that the record shows that as long as Mr. Smith was an air mask technician, he didn't have to wear a mask. And wasn't called into, I'm sorry, he didn't have to engage in firefighting. And that as far back as 1987, neither did any other air mask technician. Should that be relevant to us or not?
That's absolutely not relevant because it's the risk, correct? It's the risk of any situation, even one loss of life would be unjustifiable in this circumstance. And that's why those safety regulations exist. And that's why when you have to be ready to fight those fires at all times, even one instance would not be acceptable. And that's what we're doing. We're trying to prevent incidents. And the fact that it didn't happen before, it doesn't mean that it can't happen in the future.
You heard us talk about with your friend about intermediate scrutiny and strict scrutiny. Why should strict scrutiny not apply?
I'm sorry?
Why shouldn't we use strict scrutiny?
Oh, strict scrutiny shouldn't apply for the very reason that I just mentioned. The policy is generally applicable to anyone, regardless of whether or not they are have a 5 o'clock shadow for religious beliefs or for any other beliefs. It's absolutely generally, and every single person would be subject to that evaluation as to whether or not the 5 o'clock shadow interferes with that mask at that point in time. If it interferes with that mask, any person would be sent home. So the plaintiff in this case as well would be able to treated exactly the same in that discretion. And so it is different than the mandatory, you can't have longer than a 5 o'clock shadow rule that ACFD follows. And that's also, it's not, there's no exceptions to that rule. There's never been an exception for a medical exemption. And we have an example of that as well, where someone who requested it for a medical exemption was also denied.
But does it matter that they were denied as long as they could have been, as long as they could have been not denied?
No, because it's a general applicability. Every single person would have been denied for any reason. So it doesn't matter if it was religious or medical.
Do they have discretion on an emergency callback?
They have discretion on an emergency callback, but the treatment is the same. There's no differentiation between religion and any other secular reason or non-religious reason.
But it is left to the discretion of a supervisor, though, right?
Absolutely. And discretion, there's lots of discretion on the part of an employer. It doesn't mean that it's discriminatory. It would violate the Equal Protection Clause or would be subject to strict scrutiny just because there's discretion on a neutral law and a neutral applicability.
I'm just trying to get a sense of the conduct of ACFD's particular business. And there's a lot of testimony in the record. And the only person I saw, you know, talk about the order of operations to the extent where Mr. Smith could be called back or could be asked to suppress fire. And he testified that it was second and third, the company that's there, then the second and third due companies, reserve apparatus or RIV or something like that, emergency callback, and then mutual aid from surrounding towns. Is that accurate?
Correct. So we wouldn't go to mutual aid to surrounding towns until all of the personnel that was needed in that order could respond.
And does mutual aid cost ACFD anything?
I don't believe so, but it isn't something that, because of the mutual aid agreements, the agreements that the townships have for mutual aid agreement always have a provision where you have to use your own people first. It's an emergency situation where you don't have enough personnel, where you have to call in other people
And the storm, the storm 2020, the tropical storm, when Mr. Smith was activated, are you aware of whether or not mutual aid was activated once he did not respond, or if there was any call for mutual aid, or if it was available, unavailable, if that's in the record?
There was not, because what we had was we had the other air mask technician take his place.
Who did the air mask technician work during that storm?
I'm sorry?
Who did the air mask technician work during that 2020 incident?
I'm not sure what functions he would have performed.
No, who did it?
Oh, there's only two air mask technicians who fill that role. Uh-huh. It's a primary role to fill tanks, but the secondary role is, of course, to rescue people and to perform whatever functions need to be done at that time. So there's two of them, and the other one, the name is escaping me, but it is in the record.
Did you say that the other one was called to fight the fire?
Correct.
Okay. Who did the air mask technician work? Who was the one that was not fighting?
There wasn't anyone. That situation didn't need that. It wasn't a fire situation. It was a storm situation. Mm. So with a lot of downed trees, electrical wires, things of that nature, there was no tanks necessarily needed.
So why was a mask necessary in that situation where there was no fire?
There wasn't, well, in case there was any type of situation where a mask would be needed. But no, a mask probably...
Okay, what were the facts that would have required one to wear a mask?
I don't believe that there would have been any requirement to wear a mask in that situation, but Mr. Smith refused to appear nonetheless for whatever reason he did. And we have to be, in terms of the retaliation claim here with him not appearing, it may very well have been that he didn't need to wear a mask to perform those services. But in terms of retaliation claim, if there's a claim for retaliation based on that incident and based on subsequent incidents, it was incumbent on Mr. Smith to amend the complaint. And the complaint here was never amended with a legal theory, and we know that we can't raise legal theories of liability in an opposition brief to summary judgment.
Let's just assume for a minute that we do use strict scrutiny. Can the city win under strict scrutiny?
Absolutely, I believe so, because of the federal regulations. We can't violate those, and so therefore we need to follow those regulations for all personnel. Thank you.
Well, now, before you go, your adversary made a big point about accommodations, okay? And they said you had a duty to accommodate. Is your position it's a hard stop, we can't accommodate you, and that's it?
I believe that based on the fact that we can't question someone's sincere belief, and the only options that were presented, our alternatives that were presented, was for us to request Mr. Smith to compromise those sincere beliefs, that is not reasonable accommodation whatsoever under Title VII, under the Equal Protection Clause, under the First Amendment. We cannot question those.
So if his request had been, my religious obligation is to have facial hair, no description of length, then you agree it would have been incumbent upon ACFD to explore what lengths of facial hair,
yes,
that interfered with the seal.
I would say yes. I would say that there had to be a conversation. My understanding is that there was that representation that it had to be a 3-inch beard. He's even asserted that and confirmed that was the request in the complaint, as well as in his affidavit in support of the preliminary injunction.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll hear rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. A few quick points to pick up where my colleague left off. On page 173 of the record is Mr. Smith's original accommodation request. And he says, I'm sending this information to request an accommodation to continue to wear my beard due to my religious beliefs and convictions. There's no mention of the length. And under Gruff, the burden is on the department to have an interactive process with Mr. Smith and to discuss alternative accommodations, and they never did. To the point of cost, Your Honors, the department has not met its burden to show substantial increased costs. As Judge Porter alluded to, the cost during an emergency would be potentially, when that situation arose, if in the rare event that an air mask technician was needed to engage in fire suppression, which has happened potentially once in 37 years, another disputed fact, it would be the cost of sending in someone else, which could happen in a large department, or it could be the cost of potentially allowing him to go ahead and wear that SCBA mask with a quarter-inch beard, which there is testimony in the record at page 289, which shows that you can pass a fit test with up to a quarter-inch beard.
And Mr. Smith has done that. That evidence was him fit testing himself, I believe. Is that right?
Correct, but he also fit tested a colleague with a quarter-inch growth. And in Potter, the D.C. Circuit found that SCBA masks can safely be worn with beards. In fact, the D.C. Department conceded that back in 2007, and ever since 2007, D.C. firefighters have been wearing religious and medical beards in fighting fires.
The INSPRA, is that the same INSPRA model?
Yes, Your Honor. The SCBA mask at issue there was the same. The issue in Potter was they also wanted to use a negative pressure mask, which is more dangerous. There is actually some risk with that mask with facial hair, but the department conceded that the positive pressure mask, which is the only kind of mask that Atlantic City has ever used, can be safely worn with facial hair. And I would point, Your Honors, to the amicus brief from the Potter plaintiffs, where they explained in this case how they safely fought fires for decades with their facial hair under a religious accommodation.
On accommodation, the city says it was impossible for us to accommodate because of the state and federal regulations. One, can you address the adequacy of that as a legal matter? And two, what accommodations do you say they could have made?
First, Your Honor, the regulations do not apply to Mr. Smith because the way that the regulations specifically define the role of firefighter is someone who, quote, engages in the physical activity of rescue, fire suppression, or both. This is someone who works inside the hot zone as part of their fire suppression duties. And Mr. Smith's role at the scene of a fire, as we discussed, is specifically to stay outside the hot zone.
But let's assume that it applies. Can you address Judge Porter's question about...
Yes, Your Honor. If it applies, there are other ways to comply with the regulations. The regulations themselves are written broadly, and they contemplate alternatives. There's three interpretive letters from OSHA in the record, one from 2003 and two from 2011, and they all allude to alternatives. For example, from August 2011 at page 76, quote, there are loose-fitting respirators available that can be used effectively by bearded workers in the majority of situations where respirators are required. And then in 2003, they said there are positive pressure respirators of the hood and helmet type where facial hair and beards will have less effect on the fit. But I will also mention—
What about the fact that PIOSH is the one that is regulating ACFD, and PIOSH specifically told them that there was no accommodation? So just address whether or not, as a legal matter, that in and of itself could be an undue burden. If not, what else would be needed to show it's an undue burden?
Your Honor, PIOSH's email at page 190, that was from Patrick Bost, who's a PIOSH health official, that was only in reference to traditional firefighters who fight inside the hot zone. It was not in reference to administrative roles like air mask technicians. But even if the regulations—
Let's just assume that this is applying to him. I'm just trying to get at your legal argument.
Yes. So even if the regulations did apply here, it would not be an undue hardship preventing an accommodation for Mr. Smith, because Title VII does override, to the extent there is a conflict, which we believe there's not, because there's these other ways of complying and the regulations don't apply to him. Even if they did, Title VII does have an express provision at 2000E-7 that says it overrides state laws which, quote, require or permit an unlawful employment practice under this chapter. And I will also point your honors to three comparator cases about the exact same beard issue where the same regulations were in play. We have Potter, where the same regulations apply in the DC context, and they've never had a problem with accommodating those religious beards, and they've not been sanctioned in any way by OSHA because, again, it's not a violation. We have the California Department of Corrections case, which is post-Groff. And in this situation, it was the prison context, which obviously security and safety is top of mind there, and prisons also receive a lot of deference typically from courts. But the court there said that the California OSHA regulations were not an excuse for failing to accommodate, because the frequency of actually needing to wear a respirator for those employees was so rare. And that's comparable to Mr. Smith here. It's so rare that he would actually need to wear a respirator. And then the third case is Sugrim. This is from the Southern District of New York. And in this case, the same OSHA regs were at issue, but the court found that the department's other practices undermined its purported interest in following those regulations. And I will say here, the department has not consistently fit tested its other administrative employees, and it's also not trained them. And it was actually sanctioned by PIOSH for not training its administrative employees
wanted to follow up on a question I asked earlier. What sort of accommodations does Mr. Smith say the city should have considered?
I think the quarter-inch beard is a great one, because that's what the Potter plaintiffs have worn. They've also worn longer, but that is one accommodation that has been clearly shown to be safe with a positive pressure mask. Another accommodation would be for him to wear a full beard, but to trim it to a fit test length in the rare event that he's needed to engage in fire suppression. Another accommodation would be to call in someone else in the rare event that he's needed to engage in fire suppression. And the department's burden under Groff is to quantify the cost of those potential alternative accommodations. It's not the cost of the worst case scenario or the cost of an emergency. They have to drill down and be very specific. And the Fifth Circuit in the Hebrew versus Texas Department of Corrections case made this very clear. There was a similar concern there about an employee needing to wear a gas mask and wanting a religious beard accommodation. And the court found that the government failed to quantify any actual cost that would result. And just pointing broadly to safety concerns in that situation was not enough. They had to show specific costs that would result from accommodating that particular
employee. That was a 2023 case, right?
Correct. It was applying Groff.
Can I just ask you, is there anything in the record at all showing that Atlantic City targeted religion intentionally?
Your Honor, when Mr. Smith originally made his accommodation request, HR required him to file a complaint and to show, quote, experts and witnesses in support of his request, which is a higher burden than employees are required to show when they request an accommodation. But targeting is actually not necessary under the Free Exercise Clause. A law could be facially neutral, but still enforced in a non-neutral way. Under Lukumi and Tenafly, that's what we see here. And then it could also be not generally applicable, and that's also what we see here. So there may have been some targeting, but that's not necessary for this court's Free Exercise decision.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Any will take this case under advisement and thank counsel for their excellent briefing in this case and argument. And if you're amenable, we'd like to greet you sidebars as well, like the last case.